From the Independent Producer Project and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of unusual stories, personal documentaries, and radio movies. And today on the program...
You want a piece of me?
You see it all the time in movies, and it's always a threat. Come at me. I'm ready.
Want a piece of me? Yeah. Ooh, I'm scared now.
But in this episode, three stories of people giving away and exposing an intimate part of themselves, sometimes willingly and sometimes not.
You saying you want a piece of me?
Today on the program...
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
I don't want a piece of you. I want the whole thing!
But if you think of it, it can also be a genuine, straightforward question, an offer. Like in this first story about a woman who gave away an intimate, personal part of herself. And it was even a part she wasn't that crazy about herself. And she gave it away to a total stranger. From KCRW and KCRW.com, it's Unfictional and Being Siri.
She hid his key. So strange was the dream.
Tickle the frog with the
feather. Internet of things.
It's always cold in
you
San Francisco.
Must earn it.
Where's Lord
Please
Alfred?
Be patient.
The ripe taste of cheese.
Buy Bobby a puppy.
With age.
Nod if you,
you
are
should
all right.
Remember
she needs
that
a
you
heart.
Are a young
Gloves
person.
Are more important
can I
than
have
anything
$10?
Else. When
I owe
can
you
I go to sleep?
No one else.
Your
can
hands
help me.
Are bigger
Brothers
than mine.
And sisters
Pizza
don't always
is my
get
favorite
along.
Food.
I always spoil
we are
everything.
Cut off from all the rest of the
it
world.
It doesn't matter, I guess.
Hello. Welcome. This is my voice vault. It is still incomplete. I am a level 7 speech donor. I am donating my voice to someone I've never met. Someone I may never meet at all. Every word I'm speaking will someday be hers.
As I lean into the microphone and read out the words,
Hi.
I feel strangely like I'm speaking to her.
How are you?
We make idle chit-chat.
Good to see you.
Exchange pleasantries.
How is your cat?
Platitudes and cliches.
Good friends are forever.
I pass judgment.
Winking isn't ladylike.
And blame.
You are so careless.
I make confessions.
Ice cream
complaints,
is my guilty pleasure.
And commands.
Take the children to the zoo.
Occasionally, I say please.
Please put the groceries in the refrigerator.
I speak to her like I speak to Siri.
It's late.
When I want
and
to text my ETA to a friend from the freeway.
Order a sausage pizza for dinner.
Slowly. Dispassionately.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Tisking my T's with a faux sophistication that I once brought home from a semester abroad in Britain.
Tell me about your family.
Part of me expects her to respond, but of course she doesn't.
Tell me about it.
She can't. That's precisely the point. And in the end...
What have you done?
She isn't Siri.
Who, me?
I am.
I am made of tin.
Is that so?
I have no heart and cannot love.
I've never really thought about it.
This sounds like the real me.
Sorry, Aaron. I didn't get that.
This sounds like the real me.
I'm not sure I understand.
This sounds like the real me.
I thought so.
This is my new voice.
If you asked me how I feel about my voice, I'd probably tell you this. It's a little like my hair. A little thin, a little flat. A little mousy.
Only a mouse.
I saw a mouse once. As a kid, I dreamed of being Little Orphan Annie, belting it out on Broadway with a mop of tight, fiery curls.
We like singing.
They all drew to the fire. In second grade, I sang Maybe, off-key and a cappella in a dirty blonde bowl cut at the spring talent show. I practiced at recess for weeks. I wanted to be famous.
I am real.
I know I am real. Or maybe just to be heard. As I've grown older, I've grown happier to simply blend in.
Don't mind me. Don't laugh at me.
I've stopped singing, except alone on the highway.
I don't want to.
I've stopped dyeing my hair.
Does my hair look very bad?
I've stopped wishing my parents had named me Dorothy.
I hate my name.
There is no place like home. But I still love red shoes.
Aren't they beautiful?
And I still can't help but believe...
I've always known it.
...that if I had a different voice, I'd be a different person.
Who is the funniest?
We do want to be good. Like how I used to imagine that when I moved to a new city, I'd be somehow magically transformed. Into someone calmer or cooler or more stylish than I am.
Do you think she is pretty?
Can you talk French? Every few years, my sister cuts 10 inches off her hair and donates it to Locks of Love, where it's made into a wig for a kid with cancer. I love imagining this. The parade of little children with their chestnut brown bobs. but I've never done it myself.
Why should I do this? Why should I do this for you?
I guess the impulse to give presupposes that someone will want what you have to offer. And if I got to choose my voice,
I want that one.
I wouldn't choose this one. But for some of us, there's only this.
I communicate with a computer system in a box in the back of my wheelchair.
I use this machine for communication. I can hear and understand everything that you say.
Some of us will never sing, even badly.
I get by with a little help from my friends.
Get help now. Can you help me find my way? I don't know where it is. What are you hiding behind you?
As the words pile up, I try to remember this.
Have some coffee. It's very hot in here.
I try to hear myself as she might, from the outside, listening in.
One by one, on and on they walked.
And with each word,
does it hurt?
The sounds feel less and less like my own.
Maybe tomorrow. Maybe you're right. I'm going to sleep. Call me back when you can. I hate to think I've got to grow up.
And then suddenly, it stops.
After 3,487 sentences, I have reached level 10 at last. My voice vault now contains all of the building blocks of human speech, the seeds of an entirely new voice, which brings together the sounds of her body and of mine. I hope she will come to love it, or to hate it, like her own. I am a selfish girl. I can't get over my disappointment. I am terribly afraid of falling.
What will you do with this voice once you have it? What's the first thing you'll say? Will you use it to fall in love?
Come back. Do come back. Where have you been? Come and kiss me.
To scold a child.
Give it back. No. What did I just say? Think before you speak.
Will you say things you regret?
I never should have said it. I was going to say something else. I'll truly try to be better.
Or things that I would?
I know they will remember all I said to them. I'm so sorry.
But does it even matter? This isn't about me. It's about you.
Do you have a mother? Do you like amusement parks? Do you have a Facebook account? Do you think we're funny?
Or maybe it's about us in a way. This connection we share. This voice that isn't quite my voice or your voice, but ours.
You and me. We have neglected many things. Our road is before us.
As I speak these words, I conjure you, or an image of who I want you to be. You could be anyone.
My name is.
But who are you?
Who are you?
If I could talk with you, what would I say?
Tell me something about yourself. It's your turn to talk now.
How would it feel to hear you talking back?
That's all right. We don't have to take turns. I'm talking to myself. Goodbye.
That beautiful and intricately constructed piece was produced by Aaron Anderson, an award-winning multimedia storyteller and an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh's writing program. You're listening to Unfictional on KCRW.com. I'm Bob Carlson. Hey, and why not subscribe to the Unfictional podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts? Today on the program, you want a piece of me? Stories about people who give up a piece of themselves. Or in this next one, find a piece of someone else, just lying on the ground. It's the story of a nondescript box tossed in an alley, and the guy who found it and feels a duty to protect it. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional, and Bert finds a box.
Everything's in a jumble right now. I've looked through it and showed it to so many different people. I'm not exactly sure where all the cards are.
Chapter 1. Bert finds a box.
My name is Wilbert. It was in the summertime and I was walking through this alley that I'd walked through like 100 times before, and I saw this box. And, you know, I opened it up. I saw all these pictures and I started to get a really weird feeling. Almost kind of like deja vu. looking at the pictures, like somehow I thought that I was going to find my own picture. It's weird to see something so personal, like someone's whole life of pictures, in the public domain. This, like, potentially, you know, trash or treasure. Or it could just be rained on. Or if there's a donut at the bottom of the box, a raccoon's going to flip it over and throw it in the street. Or crows will descend on it and make a nest. I felt a responsibility when I saw it, that it shouldn't become trash. That it was, like, too important. So I just put it all in my bag, as much as I could, in the backpack that I had. Maybe I was almost missed my yoga class because I spent so much time looking through these pictures. And then after yoga, I probably went to the beach to go swimming. I think I met up with Liz there.
Chapter 2, Liz.
So he had the box and we read through everything and looked at all the pictures. And then I think through the letters, we figured out her first and last name. It's like looking at somebody's whole life.
It was a puzzle because everything's jumbled together.
Is this person their aunt or their mom in the photo?
But there is a timeline which seemed to span like 25 or 30 years.
So there's like her grandmother, her mother's like youth, and then it goes to her youth and then her high school days. She kept these like high school letters that are like, you know, some like, I miss you so much, but mostly just, you know, I don't know if you have seen these. I'm like a dog and you're the well done, sizzling, dripping with juice, T-bone steak, and I can't wait to see you. These letters are so personal that trying to track somebody down and give them back would be like really awkward because it was obvious that we had read all these like sexy notes from her high school boyfriend. But I couldn't stop looking at it.
Chapter 3, Bert and Liz become obsessed.
So the story, it seems like to me, is that she grew up in Seattle with her mom.
His mom moved here from Hawaii.
And for whatever reason, parents split up. And so her dad was living in Texas. So she would go to Texas and have these like wild summers.
There were some lurid vacations.
The ones that stick out to me the most are these like roadside Texas pictures. Okay, so here's one. So they're in a parking lot and this guy is wearing jeans, but they're like assless chaps. And everybody else in the picture is wearing full clothes, hats, jackets, and he's just bent over this like Honda Civic with his butt just completely hanging out. Why are they dressed like this right here? It makes no sense to me. And then it looks like she gets pregnant. And at one point, either before or after, she ends up getting married.
Wound up getting married to someone a lot older. In her mid-20s, I think she married like a 40-year-old guy.
There really aren't that many photos of him. I think there's like one of their wedding. But it almost is like there's more of her childhood. It's not really clear to me, like, how long they were together.
There's a set of photos that was in the envelope, maybe that never even been looked at, of her husband.
And then that guy dies. And there's a picture of him in the hospital. It's, like, really gruesome. And then there's another picture of him dead in a coffin. And then those are, like, the most recent pictures from, I think, a couple years back.
Died November 1st. 2007, which you can see on a t-shirt that someone's wearing with his picture on it, standing next to the casket.
It's just like an open casket photo, which I really don't think I've ever seen that before.
Chapter 4, Bert and Liz have theories.
So then in my head, I was like, what if something terrible happened to this lady?
I don't want to think that she's dead. Well, we looked up death certificates on her, we didn't see any evidence. She could have been incarcerated. She could have just had to flee for some reason.
She was really depressed or something. You know, she lost her husband and now all her stuff is on the street.
She left these pictures probably in a house with a bunch of people. thinking that she could come back at some point.
I mean, ideally, it would not be with Bert forever. Because this woman had kids. There's pictures of her pregnant, you know. And if she spent 30 years keeping all this stuff, I'm sure whatever happened to her, she'd want her kids to have it.
Chapter 5. Bert and Liz try and find the box's owner.
I wanted to. I really wanted to, like, have a feeling of completion and returning them to the owner, like the original person who would, like, see the pictures and look through them and maybe start crying or something. I don't know.
Then I think I kept digging and found a business license with her name on it for a bakery. We called and asked
if she was there. And the guy answered the phone and was like, very abruptly, without considering it at all, it's not here. No. And hung up the phone.
And then I think, if I'm remembering it right, Bert contacted them again.
She had two twin brothers. I think we found out by looking at their middle school yearbook. My good friend's sister in contact with him on Facebook. I think they were Facebook friends, or she searched him.
Then Bert started texting with this guy. And then I don't know what happened with that. I never actually talked to any of them. It was always Bert, and Bert can be kind of cryptic.
Chapter 6. He finds a rightful owner, but by now Bert feels a connection to the box.
Talking to him, I just got a weird feeling, like, I felt kind of covetous. I didn't really want to give the pictures back.
Wait, you didn't want to give the pictures back?
Just didn't feel like if I gave it to your brother that it would have the effect that I was looking for. So
the effect for, like, you?
For me.
Okay.
And then I guess it would be kind of like a shared thing that, like, I could get a glimpse into a world of some evocative moment. So I just never took the pictures back. It never contacted me or had any further questions, or is, yeah, it feels really uncompleted still. And at times it's weird that I was even able to forget about it.
Chapter 7. Bert keeps the box.
I've shown them to other people and noticed that they think it's kind of cool and interesting, but they don't quite look at them the same way that I do.
I really like watching people look through them, but it's like the more people you show, like, the more messed up it is, kind of. Or like the stickier it gets with whether or not you're, like, doing something morally wrong by showing people.
Epilogue. Liz has regrets.
I once left my diary, like, in a house that I lived in, and then all of my old roommates when I moved out read it and, like, tried to figure out whose it was. And, like this, like, they sat around and they read it out loud and they, like, laughed and giggled. I really do feel like it is kind of rude, the fact that we didn't stop reading it. That sucks. Like, why wouldn't you just read the first page and realize it's personal and close it? If I were her, I don't know if I'd really want to know that a whole bunch of random people know so much about my life.
Bert Finds a Box was produced by Hans Anderson, an independent radio producer living in Seattle. The narrator was Gareth Ainsworth. And we checked in with Bert recently. Oddly, he still hasn't found out the identity of, but he still has the box. You're listening to Unfictional on KCRW.com. I'm Bob Carlson, and today, you want a piece of me? And finally on the program, a story about a woman paying a visit to a clinic. The procedure should be straightforward, but it's not, because the procedure is an abortion, and the woman lives in Brazil. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
My name is Cynthia Bonacossa, and I'm from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. I think I was 23 or 24, and I was still in med school when this happened. I wasn't very happy doing medicine and stuff, so I was kind of irresponsible with my life. I was very careless. my breasts got very big and tender, and I started to get really emotional. And then when my period didn't come, I was like, oh, damn. The way I got pregnant was basically because I didn't use a condom with this guy I had some sort of relationship with. Just one time we were drunk and we didn't use it, and boom, I got pregnant. Ugh, I felt nauseous. I felt, well, there you go. I've really f***ed up now, like really done it. In Brazil, abortion is illegal and you can go to jail for about 3 years for having an abortion. And I think for 4 years if you perform an abortion. What women do in Brazil is usually just call your friends and see who knows someone who knows someone who knows someone. It's a bit like finding a drug dealer. Like you have to have connections or something. I had a number, but I didn't know if it was going to work. They had a police raid the week before. I called and I said I wanted to make an appointment. The woman said, okay, can you come like tomorrow morning? I was really, really scared of just, you know, something bad happening or having a complication or, I don't know, it's an illegal clinic. So there have been lots of like news stories about women who were found dead because they went in to have an abortion at some clinic and something went wrong and then they just threw the body away. I wrote a letter to my parents. I love you and I'm so sorry. And P.S. I want to be cremated. It was Brazilian autumn, so it was, you know, like fresh. The trees were really rustling, you know, the leaves, and I had that kind of like American Beauty moment of just like, oh, I might never see the trees again. Bye. It looks like a normal little clinic from the outside. It looks like, you know, you'd go to a dermatologist in there or your gynecologist. So she like buzzed the gate and I went inside. Everything was very white, very clean, and like some artwork hanging, joyful and colorful and all over the wall. And on one wall, there was like this painting of a saint. And then they led us into these two waiting rooms. Kind of looked like a classroom a little bit, just a lot of chairs, hospital bed. There was like five women, including me. I kind of expected only young women like me, people who screwed up and who are young. And no, but very different, like two older women, me and another who were kind of like in our early 20s and this other one who was like in her 30s or something. Everybody's tense. Everybody's doing something illegal. You don't know how much you want to talk. But then one of the women just started like, oh, yeah, so I'm here because I was married for 2 years. I tried to have a baby for so long. And then my husband divorced me. And then the first time I go out, I went to this party and I had sex with this guy. And boom, I'm pregnant. So she was like just spilling her life out. So everybody kind of just went with it, I guess. The law assistant, she said, like, oh, I already have some kids. I can't have another kid. I'm done. And my husband, he's in the car crying because he wants to have this baby. But I'm done. I just can't do this anymore. The teenager, the one that was, like, closer to my age, she kind of annoyed me. She was just, like, freaking out, you know, like, I don't know how it happened. I always take the pill. Oh, my God, this is so stressful. She's like, oh, calm down. Suddenly, a nurse came busting in. Everybody get up. Go, go, go. You're going upstairs. What's going on? The police. We all ran up and we went to this like storage room, two nurses and us. They locked the metal door. Two of the women were freaking the hell out. They were like, oh my God, oh my God. They had this little TV that showed what was going on in the front of the clinic. We just saw the police standing outside the door for a while with the guns. Like butterflies in your stomach, you feel kind of sick. It's like, please don't let them come in. I just imagine that somebody would open the door, they would come in pointing the guns and would search the clinic looking for us, and then we'd all go to jail, you know. We saw this woman coming out of the clinic and talking to them and then leaving with the two policemen. And then we're like, oh, what's going on? What's going to happen? And then this nurse came and she's like, it's me, you can open up. And so we open up the door and like, what happened? They showed up to pick up their bribe. And the person apparently wasn't there with the money. So this woman, she went out and she left with the police to pay them. After they said that, I was like, yeah, duh, of course they pay the police off to leave them alone. We went back downstairs, and that's when we actually had to start, like, the big, big wait of 5 hours. Everybody was like, where's the doctor? Is the doctor coming? Like, yeah, he's in traffic, but he's coming. He's arrived. He'll be here soon. When the doctor comes, the nurse comes in and says, like, who wants to go first? And the legal assistant jumps up and goes, me! When we arrived, I was the second one to arrive, and there was this other girl who was the first one to arrive, and this woman cut line, you know, she cut in line to have an abortion. I was the third one to go in. They take you into this little room with the, chair with the stirrups. It looked very sterile and nice. I felt, oh God, yeah, they finally, oh, it's gonna be over soon. They put a drip on me and they told me to count back from 10 and I black out. I woke up from the pain, I think. I mean, it feels like there's a fist holding your uterus and going like squishing it and in the process kind of pulling on everything around it. I thought I was going to die because this isn't normal. This is not normal. I called the nurse. Calm down. I'm going to give you some Tylenol. So I took the Tylenol and I kind of blacked out afterwards. When I came to again, it felt like a normal cramp. It hurt as hell, but it was just like, I can deal with this. This is normal. I'm not going to die, I guess. This sounds weird, but you kind of feel like empty. You feel like there's something in you, and then suddenly there isn't, and it's like you have your body back, I guess. It's just like, it's just me now. It's nothing else. The girl who was around my age, but she was younger than me, we were sitting next to each other, and she was crying, and I thought that maybe she was just going through what I was, you know, just through the pain. And I was like, are you okay? They have Tylenol. Oh, he didn't deserve this. And she felt bad about having an abortion. And that's when I felt more compassionate towards her. It's not a he yet. It's just, you know, it's a little bunch of cells. And if he were to be born, would you be able to take care of him? Would you be a good mother? Do you think you're ready to be a mother now? You feel awful. You feel sad. But I felt very deeply that I couldn't be a mother, you know, at that point. Yeah, that's the thing. It's supposed to change you or something, but it didn't, you know? I mean, I don't think so. I did have an abortion. That's part of, like, my life, and I don't think I should be embarrassed about it either. It wasn't at all pleasant. I did what I had to do, and it was okay. And it was over.
That story was produced by Benjamin Frisch, an independent podcast producer and artist in New York. Cynthia Bonacossa is a med school graduate turned cartoonist. To see Cynthia's artwork and a comic she made about her abortion experience, go to our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from crw.com.